All right. We are live for another Presidio Bitcoin Jam. And we've got all three of us in studio. That's exciting.
Very exciting.
Welcome back, Max.
Yeah. Excited to be back.
We really missed you because you were kind of like with us for, I think, 30 seconds or 5 minutes or something last week. And then we kind of just fell off and the audience couldn't hear you. But now we got your smiling face and get to hang with you in person.
So. As we said, we're still work in progress, getting everything figured out for the pod. But poco a poco, we're getting there and it's good to be back.
Yep. Well, we make it as hard as possible on ourselves too, right?
Of course.
We have every possible configuration. We're doing a live stream. We do post-production. We also do one remote, two remote, three remote, zero remote.
So yeah.
We're getting there. It's definitely most enjoyable to do the show with all three of us.
Being IRL, I mean, I don't think there's any replacement for that ever. So we got to savor it while we got it.
But we did. So we got to command the stage last week. Yeah. And I think there are a couple topics we touched on that you have a few things to add.
Yeah. So, I mean, last week there was a lot of great stuff you guys discussed, but a couple things I just wanted to touch on. I tried to do it in the chat, but obviously it's not quite as rich. You know, the first thing is on the IP debate. I thought that was a very interesting and rich topic. And I know we're going to talk maybe a little bit about some decentralization of Nostr, social media in general, and Ross Ulbricht's take on that. And Ross, actually, I think, you know, by the way, I read his Medium 2021 article. Yep. And if you haven't read that yet, I highly recommend anyone check it out, talking about the decentralization of social media. I, you know, obviously wasn't super familiar with him other than knowing sort of the abstract, but he's extremely intelligent. I didn't realize that until reading this article. And he talks about the IP debate in there, you know, sort of tangentially, but I think he just hits it nail on the head. Which basically is, you know, when you think about how the world works, atoms and bits are fundamentally different. And the more that you can lean into nature, how it actually works, and stop trying to impose artificial sort of constructs of the mind, the easier things flow. You know, one of my heroes, Buckminster Fuller, always said, use forces, don't fight against them. And in the case of the internet, and as we think about the internet, as we think about monetizing things with Bitcoin over time, I think it's very important that we recognize how reality works, which is that information does in fact want to be free. It is in fact infinitely copyable. And whenever we try and think of an old mode of production in the world of atoms, where atoms are not free and you can't infinitely copy them, and you try and sort of bolt on or paste on an old paradigm to a different system, of course it's not going to work, or it's not going to work naturally. So I think my biggest thing on sort of the IP debate is, if we recognize nature as it is, which is that information is infinitely copyable, it is not in fact scarce, and then try and impose artificial scarcity, those models are always going to have leaks. As Ross mentions in his article, if you want to keep something secret, there's always going to be whistleblowers. And if you want to keep something confined, there's always going to be a peer-to-peer file sharing network. So it's always, you know, it may take a certain amount of time, but it's going to get out there. And so I think the more we can acknowledge that and figure out, not that we don't want to monetize content creators. I mean, as a somewhat of a content creator with you guys, but also, you know, as a once and hopefully future rapper, again, I want people to get paid. But I think the real and interesting challenge for us right now is, how do you develop business models that recognize this reality? So value for value is one example of that. There's many others, without fighting nature.
And I read a brief overview of the 2021 Medium blog post that you shared. And as I was reading it, I did not know the date was 2021. And I was like, huh, he's kind of sounds like he's talking about Nostr, but he's not mentioning Nostr by name. That's a little weird.
Yeah.
Then I looked at the date. I was like, oh, actually, it makes sense. So I haven't gotten a full deep dive on it, but I was a little bit surprised. Some of his diagrams seemed to assume the world of like, users, he didn't call them relays, but like servers or data stores or whatever. And then he kind of had advertisers.
Yeah.
And for me, like, advertisers sort of don't fit into this world, because if it's decoupled from the server or the relay, like, or, you know, decoupled from the client, how do advertisers sort of wedge in? Is it like, isn't everything just payments?
Well, and so I guess we're going to go ahead and skip ahead and talk a little about sort of the Nostr decentralization. But to be clear, I mean, he wrote this in 2021, so there's a lot of beautiful thinking in there, but a lot has changed in what's possible. Like, he wasn't even assuming Bitcoin, the Lightning Network, instant payments when he wrote this article.
Maybe he's Fiat Jeff.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe. I mean, it wouldn't be surprising. But I think there's two interesting discussions to have around that. One interesting discussion is, how do you monetize online services in a world where information is free? One possibility is advertising, right? And so you could, in fact, have, you know, where the user is centric, a user paid for his or her attention, and you could have people still competing. I mean, I heard you guys work for a small advertising company back in the early 2000s. You could, in fact, build, much, much smaller versions of ad networks like Google's or whatever that could run on a decentralized system. I think that's a topic that's not been very well explored.
So it's more like a user choosing to opt in their attention into this advertising experience, go through the experience, earn Bitcoin,
right,
and then spend it in a payment mechanism wherever they need to pay.
Yeah, and there's like Slice, I think, is an example. It's a small browser extension that pays you very, very tiny units of Bitcoin for your attention. So that is a model. It's not the one I'm excited about. And I think that he, in that article, did not think a lot about value for value models, paywall models, other models. But advertising is one possibility.
Mm-hmm.
The more interesting thing, though, that I think I wanted to discuss with you guys and get your sort of honest feedback and take on, because I think this is a true discussion that, even though you guys know I'm a Nostr fanboy, you're a Nostr fanboy, you're a pretty big Nostr fanboy.
Yeah. Well, but relatively speaking, I'd be the critic.
I'd be the critic. Yeah. So I'm curious your take on this. But I think, Ross, what got me to read this article in the first place is he made a post that just hit the nail on the head. And his post basically said, I love all the aspects of Nostr. It matches a lot of what I was thinking in that article from 21. But there's one giant elephant in the room or question, which is, what's the business model for the relays? And some other people that I really respect, I won't dox them here. One of them doxed himself on Nostr, so I'll mention it, EK, who works at Stacker News, another company we're all friends with and involved with, had a similar criticism, which is, do we need pay to post?
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, the question is, if you don't have some small pay to post or similar kind of mechanism, is there a business model to have enough relays to keep the network decentralized? Million, the founder of Primal, came back and said, listen, we're already seeing essentially subsidization of this, where you don't have to do pay to post, but companies like Primal run relays. They make money in other ways, like subscription services or badges that you flex. But because they're making money in those ways, they can subsidize relays, and there's probably going to be enough businesses to do that. That's my intuition, but I do think this is an open question.
I mean, I think the cost of everything is just going to continue to go down. So like the cost of data store is going to go down. And if you do opt your attention into an advertiser, or you put a little bit of Bitcoin in a wallet, it seems natural that you wouldn't even think about it. You know, actually, Kevin Kelly calls it too cheap to meter.
I like that, yeah.
Which is like, it's like your phone. Remember, you used to actually pay, you'd buy like 100 text messages per month or whatever. And now nobody even thinks about text messages. It's all
over
IP.
I'm old enough to remember paying long distance phone calls.
Oh, yeah.
Like exorbitant amount of money.
I'm old enough. I'm younger than Steve, but I'm old enough to remember that you used to have like your local calling, and you'd have like zone A, B, C, and D. And I was only allowed to connect to the BBSs that were in zone A. My dad was like, I don't want you getting on zone B and C.
Were you guys using the telegraph too?
Well, since we're trying to compete on how old we are, my grandmother, she lived in a farm in Iowa. And I remember when I was a kid, I'd be at her house, and her phone line was a shared phone line. This is like plain old telephone service.
Oh, yeah.
Shared phone line with our neighbors. So like you literally pick up the phone and you're listening to your neighbor's conversation.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I didn't know that was
my dad's dad had a payphone at his house. You had to put a quarter in.
Are you serious?
It's just cheap. Yes.
You're not joking.
No, I'm serious. It was back in the day, you know?
Wow.
Okay. Also, like in my own, like my parents had the rotary dial phones, because that's how it communicated over plain old telephone service. So,
but you think about like, so my grandfather was doing pay to call from his home, an outbound call, because it was a real cost, 25 cents, whatever it was. And then it got to like text messages where, you know, you'd buy a bundle of them from AT&T or Sprint or whatever. You'd buy 500 messages for the whole month and don't use them all up. And that just seems like such a bizarre concept. We couldn't imagine thinking about text messages or paying for text messages. It's bizarre, right? But that's not like, that's not like 50 years ago. That's like 10 15?
To 12.
Yeah, somewhere in that range.
I actually remember that too. So
yeah,
I,
okay. So even the little kids know.
Right.
But like my point is, these things get where it's like too cheap to meter. You've got some value in some wallet and then you just use it and you don't even think about it. And I think to make relays sustainable, I think we have to get to that, you know, something like that, where you've got your Primal wallet or whatever, and it's just like, it knows to do, you know, dole out a little bit to the relays that are supporting you. Mm-hmm. And it's such small amounts that nobody worries about it or thinks about it. You don't even think about the weight of pay to post. Like even in Stacker News today, I think it's like maybe 100 sats, I think they call it. Sorry, Steve.
Bitcoin.
But I think they may call it 100 sats, but it's 100 Bitcoin. But you pay 100 Bitcoin to post in at least the Bitcoin sub forum, you know, community territory. But you're like very explicitly paying,
right,
and it's visible to you.
Right.
I think that stuff's all just going to disappear because it's going to be so, like, you're just like using the infrastructure. Like you probably subscribe to like a mobile phone service, right?
Yeah, actually, I have Google Fi, and it's pretty bad.
Oh, you do? Okay.
That's another story.
But like those have like limits on how much bandwidth you can use, but it's just so big that you don't really think about it, right?
Yeah.
Interesting. Social media should feel like that.
So even in that world where things get too cheap to meter, though, there's still the cost. It maybe goes asymptotic with zero, but it's never zero.
Yeah.
So do you think that basically it will always be businesses who are able to subsidize these costs because they're making money in other ways and it's just like such a small line item for them? There'll be enough of these businesses.
Well, not a direct answer to your question, but it also feels like there's a lot of business model exploration.
Yep.
So we want to see that play out.
Yep.
And we're starting to see that play out, but there's like years of that ahead of us.
Yeah, true.
And then what about, maybe I'm wrong, but like, I mean, like I get there'll be Nostr relays, which support like lots of content, but can there be just Nostr relays, which are just for the fringe or the higher risk censored content? And they, I mean, are they able to limit that? Or, I mean, they can't see the content. So how would a Nostr relay?
See.
Okay.
Right. Cause you're just transporting, as a relay, you're just transporting it, but you can use the public keys.
So it seems like there might be like,
it could be encrypted.
Non-profits are just, it's too cheap to meter, but the way you keep the cost down, or you're not trying to serve every purpose. You're just trying to help with higher risk censored content.
Yeah.
And there's just volunteers around the world that'll do that because they're ideological about it.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like the Tor network today. Libraries run Tor nodes, exit nodes, things like that. Although one might argue that if the Tor network was economically incentivized, Tor might actually be like not some weird fringe thing. But I think there's two other things to keep in mind on this. One is, to your point, not just for fringe content, but people can run relays for all kinds of weird micro communities. You could run your own relay, and I think there will always be hobbyists. And one of the other things that I'm not super deep in the technology on, but I think is very promising, is this whole concept of, I think it was once called the outbox model. I don't know what they're calling now, gossip, or maybe it was gossip, now it's the outbox model. But the idea that if you set a standard where relays are constantly chatting with each other as well and sharing notes,
mm-hmm.
whether that's economically or ideologically, if it seems like economically it'll be more likely, then even if you have a couple of big centralized relays for all of the long tail of communities, you probably won't need those centralized relays.
Also, I could imagine like the Googles and Amazons of the world, or the future Googles and Amazon, like the large companies, if either literally they or the future Amazons adopt Nostr for their content distribution, so they now have a vested interest in Nostr working.
Yeah.
I could see them just, especially if it's like too cheap to meter, like they'll just do it because it just makes sense for business, even though it, in and of itself, it's not a profit center.
Yep.
And yes, maybe they do have certain policies and they restrict certain content or whatever for legal reasons or political reasons or whatever, but they'll at least handle large volumes,
right,
of traffic on Nostr. And as long as censorable content or content they're not relaying, as long as there's credible answers to why others will do that,
right,
and others can do that, then that seems like a pretty good balance too.
Yeah. I think that's fair. And I think that, you know, it'll probably be some kind of like Pareto distribution where like vast majority of the content, we talked about this in the content of Blossom servers,
yep,
though we've gotten some potential insider info that maybe Blossom servers are cheaper than we thought. But I mean, I still think it makes sense that like centralized is probably going to be cheaper in the long run for 80, 90, maybe 99% of the content. It's no big deal. And then the long tail has this option.
Yeah. I mean, the big unlock here is like if the like content on YouTube, only YouTube can serve it up.
Mm-hmm.
So if they make policy decisions about this, these categories aren't permissible, you're just out of luck. You can, if you're a content creator, you can use different tools and just different distribution mechanisms, but you can't do it through YouTube. But with Nostr, that's not the case.
Yeah.
YouTube can cut out, have those policies, cut out that content. but the same clients can consume your censored content from this relay but through other relays. Yeah. I know I'm talking Nostra 101, but like in the context of our conversation, I think that just really highlights the, you know, the potential and promise of Nostra.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, I'm a convert. I'm a Nostra.
Well, you do have some skepticism, or what's your sort of holdback right now? Like if you wanted to really poke your biggest holes into Nostra, what does that look like?
Yeah, let's see. Certainly, there's the, you know, does it scale, like the technical analysis of it. And I mean, it's an extremely simple protocol. There's other protocols that are far more sophisticated and at least on paper and theory, scale better, have better privacy, better security, like all these different parameters that make a robust internet and infrastructure.
Are there examples of the more robust ones that come to mind that like we should be considering, or kind of some of the contours of what that would look like? Are there things that...
I don't know. I'm not an expert in that area, but like, I don't know. The people who are experts who are criticizing Nostra certainly know about those other things. Yep. But, and I mean, just through our conversations, like, I mean, I think the attitude you need to have is, yes, it's simple, but simple can grow fast. And when it grows fast and really gets... It'll attract engineers who work on infrastructure and security and privacy and scaling and add that on over time. I believe that is absolutely possible, but certainly one critique is that like it has a lot of infrastructure challenges along those dimensions, scaling, privacy, security. And so at the very least, just the uncertainty of, is that going to be addressed? And some critics might say, like, you got to address that up front in the protocol and it can't be tacked on later.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's more of the just the adoption criticism. Like, and I think this one's stronger with people who view it as social media or a Twitter clone.
Right.
Or X clone or whatever. So it's just network effects. It's like, you can't directly compete head on with X. And I agree with that, actually. I don't, if it's literally a clone of X, just selling decentralization or like, oh, some content censored is not going to win over the masses. So I usually think a Nostra is just more of a completely different content distribution mechanism that can, as opposed to the, you know, and more of an abstract view than just social media. I mean, it can be like reviews on wallet scrutiny, or it can be all kinds of content, or, you know, blog posts and Instagram clones or whatever. So I think thinking through that lens helps address that criticism. Like, okay, maybe it never succeeds as an exact Twitter clone. That's fine. That doesn't mean this infrastructure can't succeed. So thinking of it more as infrastructure. And then as far as like, can it ever facilitate like next gen social media? I think you just somehow have to like change the rules to succeed. So maybe AI changes the rules or payments or utilizing Bitcoin, either like literally as payments or zaps or whatever, or like as a anti-spam or increasing the quality of the content or something like that. Or maybe the vending machine model for different feeds. I like that concept a lot. I don't know if it's like marketable enough on its own to get people to switch, but like it feels more like the kind of thing, like once people need another reason to switch, and when they do switch, then they'll use that model and they won't go back because they get hooked on that. That wasn't much of a critique, but like those are some of concerns I've heard or concerns I have.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, sorry. Yeah. Last one, which we have talked about.
The big
one. Okay. Well, we've talked about it. We talked about Kian a couple of years ago. It's just centralization.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, I mean, it does seem like the most, out of all the candidate solutions today, it's the most decentralized or has the opportunity to be most decentralized. But as we all know, like just humans tend to want to centralize things. So, just the fear of like, let's say Primal becomes the next Google. I mean, Primal becomes like incredibly successful, incredibly successful. And like, so yeah, they're more than happy to run as many relays as needed and they ramp up and scale and they're delivering the most features. But then, their interest level in standards processes declines over time because it's like the standard process isn't moving as fast as my company wants to move. And we want to launch features. We have customer demand. They want this new feature. We can deliver it tomorrow. We don't want to wait 3 years for everyone else to roll it out and bicker and, you know, and so you just neglect the standards process. Well, then what happens is like they centralize, they run the relay and they run the client and they've got, you know, 300 million or 800 million or 2.5 billion people using it. They own and control it. So avoiding that future is always going to be a challenge. I'm not saying it's impossible, but like that's also like a kind of a good problem to have too. Like if we get to that point, that would be incredible.
I think you'd still have, you know, effectively what like the role that Coinbase plays in Bitcoin is like concerning from centralization in many ways, but they don't actually control Bitcoin. It's still open. You can take it out. You can do whatever you want with it, right?
Well, that's a good example.
Not yet, but you could argue, and I think this is why people are having these debates, right? Like if Coinbase at this stage, you know, is not big enough, but if they end up, like there is a supply threshold where is it 5%? Is it 50%? Is it 80%? At some point it becomes concerning.
It's a good example. I'll retract that statement a little bit. I mean, it's kind of a good example, but I think Bitcoin's more sophisticated than Nostr in terms of the game theory play. And I mean, if you look at the BCAP analysis, whatever, you know, 6 stakeholder categories, and just how those stakeholders categories and the players within each stakeholder group, the interplay is way more complex and sophisticated than I think like Nostr relays and clients.
For sure. Yeah. I'd say like that it's still very simple. And I think when it's simple, it lets a lot of people propose different problems to how should scalability work? How should privacy work? If it takes too much of a view up front, I think it ends up locking into something that may not be right. So in a sense, I think it's good that it's simple and it can be sort of a bunch of different solutions can be explored to address each of those things. I would highlight one thing you said, which I haven't quite, I don't know exactly how you said it, but it triggered in my mind the fact that like people think of social media as a thing the way they experience it today. But if you look like Twitter's been around, what, 18 years or whatever it's been. It was so vastly different back when it was only text messaging. And then it was vastly different when there were like no media outlets. Like you wouldn't see the New York Times on Twitter. It was just like your friends or tech people or stuff like that. And now it kind of had its like, you know, it just has like different political spectrum gravitates in one way or another. It had kind of the DEI era and then the Elon era. And it's like, that's like an evolving thing. And so it's not that Twitter has this fully dominant network effect that's unassailable. It's like there's a certain way that people use that tool today in that network. But the next evolution, whatever that is, we don't know what that's going to look like. It probably involves AI-generated content to some extent. We don't know what that looks like. And we know that Twitter's kind of locked into the feature set and the patterns that they've developed. You know, they can build new features, but they're probably not going to be able to overnight just transform into a public-private key pair, you know, identity system.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, and sort of the architectures of relays and stuff. So I actually think, you know, we don't even know how people will use social media in the future or what that means in the future. It's going to be so vastly different.
Agreed. I can't imagine the argument to disagree with that, right? I mean, just looking at the history, like Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and Snapchat.
Technology always changes. I do want to add one more thing that I think is super critical and gets not only to Nostr, but to the infrastructure of the internet itself, which I think is very important. If I were to go kind of further with the arguments you were saying around centralization risks, I think the most critical thing is the actual packets themselves. And I think this is actually a very, very important debate that not enough people are having. So it's not just the storage, which is, or the pay to post, the initial, at least direction note that people are talking about. But if you listened, I've mentioned this talk many times because I think it's one of the greatest talks on the internet. Drew Bansal, 2018, Blockchain Mind Candy. That guy saw so much, so far ahead. I'm at least 10% of those views. I can't endorse it enough. But, you know, his view for how the internet would evolve was not with something like Nostr. I think of Nostr as sort of diagonally tacking into payments via the Lightning Network. His view was that eventually we would have information routed within the Lightning Network itself. And so this was actually a very kind of interesting debate, which I think it looks like we know what's one short term, but I don't think we know what's one long run. And so the question was, do you embed the message within a Lightning payment, which is what Sphinx Chat was like an early pioneer of like 5 years ago, whenever that was? Or do you embed the payment within the message, which is what Nostr has become? In the short run, I think it's very clear that it's not going to scale with what we have today, embedding the message within the payment. No chance. However, if you think about the logic of how these systems evolve, in the early days, people would not have guessed we would end up with the centralized internet we have today. And I could see to your point, Primal, which becomes Google, which is great, or whoever, whatever. It's a very slow, it's the frog boiling over time. And you don't see it until 50 years in the future. Like, holy shit, wait a second, the internet is centralized again. And the choke points are still bandwidth, storage, and compute. And the sort of next evolution that I most look forward to seeing, and I mentioned this is something I want to invest in multiple times in the show, although maybe we're too early for a team investable and this is sci-fi, but is if you really want these networks to remain decentralized, you need ways to pay for packet routing directly, packet storage or whatever bits of information storage, and the actual computation. And if you can set up a world where those clouds are truly decentralized or distributed, then I think we've finally won on the decentralized front, at least as far as my brain is able to see. But if we don't get there, I can totally see, a couple decades we're having this conversation. But like, remember when we were so naive and thought this was going to work? Fuck.
Back when we used to pay for our cell phones.
Yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. So this makes me kind of wonder a question, because I don't know that I've seen that video recently. I think I saw it maybe a while ago when you shared it.
Yeah.
But is there some future, if Kian's right that everything should be a pay to post?
Yeah.
Is there a future where like people who choose to run a Lightning, is it an LSP, the routers, right?
You could run your own node, which is not necessarily a provider for someone else, but for yourself.
But could you be like, will the role of an LSP and a relay converge?
Could.
Does that seem likely? Because if you're paying to post and they want to collect the post and they want to route, like, is that just like a natural conclusion we might come to from the Dhruv comment?
When you say LSP, you could even broaden that to just any kind of operator server that is facilitating Bitcoin payments.
Mm. Yeah, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
Maybe all of these things are...
They're definitely like logically separated, but as an operator, are you going to like, is your economic incentive and business strategy incentive to do both? I think I've made that point before. So I think yes.
So yes.
In fact, I think I was making the argument yes, and David was arguing the other side.
You converted him.
I don't know. It's a good one. I think it's my own idea.
Inception.
Well done, Steve.
That's what I'm an expert at. I think so. Because it's in, my argument at that, this was a couple of years ago we talked about this, I think, but if you have a relay and you're getting paid by people in Bitcoin and it's in your best interest to make sure the Bitcoin payments are flowing payment success, it works, it's robust.
Yeah.
So you can rely on third parties, but it's definitely in your interest to have that be robust and you can make money off of it. So I think it's not like a requirement, but it definitely makes sense to me. And then maybe if it like really makes sense because it makes so much money and it's so important for reliability or whatever, maybe like you almost have to do it to stay in the game.
I actually think this is a very important breakthrough. I've also thought about this a little bit in a slightly different context years ago, but it's coming back up to the surface right now, which is to go back to my original point, use forces, don't fight against them. Figure out where the natural scarcities are and monetize there. Don't force monetization on an old world thinking.
Yeah.
And if you think about where all of this is going in the future, and this was a lot of the logic of my first fund, I hope it wasn't too early and it still ends up working out, but what is scarce in this future world? Well, information is never going to be scarce. Posting probably never going to be scarce. Bitcoin's going to be scarce. And specifically, routing will always be scarce, no matter what. What I always thought of this is...
Routing is scarce because it's tied to the machines and power and stuff
because
like that.
It's tied to like certain spots in the network, right? There are network effects around this. Mm-hmm. Like you want to be, for example, if I have a super central position in the network and I can route much cheaper than you can, and there's going to be always like little lots of subnetworks, then that is a scarce position. There's only so many connections because there's only so much Bitcoin that you can open. And so the way I've always thought about this is in the 21st century, if Bitcoin is the new gold, I think, and we're very early for this, so it sounds kind of crazy at this point, but imagine we're all crazy. The entire global economy flows and it's all Bitcoin. It's all on Lightning, you know, and whatever various other Lightning related things. But I think of this as the grand centrals. Like if you're an investor and you want to make money on this and the whole economy flows to Lightning, where do you make money? Well, you want to own Grand Central. And there's not going to just be one Grand Central. What I mean by that is like, it's like the new railroads. You want to be the centralized hub with economies of scale that makes as much money as humanly possible from being in the best routing position. And that is something that's defensible. And so, and there's not just going to be one, to be clear, because there's going to be subnets, right? For different, and this has also been one of my sort of theses in investing, is there's going to be for different regulatory regimes, right? Maybe Brazil, there's a different, you know, number one router for that country because of political or regulatory or just like connection right. reasons. There's going to be a different one, you know, maybe very focused on a certain kind of content or AI stuff, just because that's where that network gradually emerged. So I think this is a great point, and I would encourage more people to think about this. The logic of this in the long run is maybe Primal or Domus or whoever else needs to run a routing node.
Is there any reason, either for the benefit of Lightning or for the benefit of Nostra, maybe both, is there any reason to try to push toward this future faster? Like, should we be trying to find people who are already doing one and encourage them to do the other for some reason? Or is it just sort of like, let them all evolve on their own?
I mean, my general thought is nature is going to nature. It's going to do its own thing. Can thinking and getting people ideas like this push it forward a little bit? Maybe.
That sounds like some of my friends who hold Bitcoin, and then I might talk about like, oh, there's so many things to do and risks, and we got to solve these problems. And it's like, eh, it'll all work itself out. But like,
as long as Steve's.
But I'm like, yeah, it's, like what? Yeah,
Steve's going to work it out for us.
Yeah, I got to work it out for everyone. Yeah. By thanks, the way, so we have audience engagement.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for
Diana. So,
and she would like, she wants to hear more about what I was starting to say about Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram. So I don't think it was some brilliant insight. But just to elaborate on it, history has shown, I think a lot of people like when MySpace was popular, then it was king for a short period of time. And then in that window of time, I think most people would be like, you know, Facebook's not going to come along and like displace it quickly. Well, Facebook came along and displaced it quickly. Facebook became king. And then I think there's a lot of people then are like that it's just over. They won social media category. And I mean, kind of like Google won search, and like, you know, Microsoft won operating systems and Google won search, and they actually did those categories. Social media is different though than operating systems and search. And we have evidence of that, right? Because then Instagram came along, and yes, Facebook bought them, but it's a completely different format. Snapchat came along, remained independent, and it became extremely popular. Twitter, and then maybe if you're like, we're done, there's no more. And then TikTok came out of nowhere, and Mark Zuckerberg, I think, just testified saying it's like been the biggest competitive threat the past whatever so many years. Mm-hmm. So I think I just don't even understand how someone could possibly say we're done exploring social media and how people want to interact with other people with content.
So you're saying
how to
Ethereum
discover content.
That was my takeaway too.
So that was really all my point was. I mean, it was just like providing evidence to David's point about where social media is not done in terms of innovation.
Yep. Cool. Well, I want to keep us all on time because we've got a lot of stuff to cover. And this has so far been an Oster News, which we've been fortunate to have Steve join us for our old thing. But I think before we move on from Nostra, I think you had something about like a bounty idea that you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, just an update on that, because I think it's kind of interesting. So 2 weeks ago, we were all talking about vibe coding. As we know, DK is a professional vibe coder. Steve's been doing some vibe coding, has friends that are vibe coding. And I think everyone was kind of blown away. I was a little frustrated because I went in with like false expectations of, oh, I'm going to one shot everything and it's going to be done. Yeah. Like, okay, we're still not there yet. Obviously. but what I did kind of hit on was this idea that I keep coming back to, which is that even if you can't one shot everything, even, you know, 10 years from now, you know, the barrier to building something cool is still going to come down dramatically. So if there's how many software engineers are in the world today, or people that can code? 50 million?
Probably not that much.
I was going to say 10 to 20 million, but some on the order of 10 to 15
tens of millions of users of coders, right? So there's no question in my mind that with vibe coding, we at least go up an order of magnitude, probably two orders of magnitude of more people that can do something, right? So maybe you go from 10 million to 100 million or even a billion that can do something. And in that world, the idea that I'm really excited about is, you know, combining that force with the force of decentralized payments, Bitcoin, Lightning, with, you know, basically free markets for getting your thing done. And so an idea I think you actually incepted in me a while ago, and I've mentioned over and over again, but I really want to see this, is in something like Replit. Like Replit's early business model was so cool to me. And I know it hasn't worked out that way, but teach people how to code. Then they added bounties. And if, you know, more and more people learn how to code, and especially in countries like India or emerging markets where a little bit of money goes a long way, then instead of me having to figure everything out myself, I can go to this and now just say like, hey, I'll pay you $100 to build this thing for me or whatever. Yep. Just more people can do stuff. And, you know, they've gone more enterprise, but I still think there's a huge opportunity to build that sort of vibe coding plus bounty platform. Maybe they're different. Maybe they're together. And so I was just like, you know what? I want to test this.
Yeah. This is a great use of payments. Did you have something else on that? You did.
Well, no. So I tested it. I basically just said, you know, I want this thing built. I can't one shot it myself.
Yeah.
And so I offered out two ideas and I said, I'll pay you 100,000 Satoshis and I want it done within 36 hours. So it was like a tight window, or maybe it was 48 hours. And, you know, they didn't get it exactly, but someone that was working on a similar project that I wasn't aware of. One, it surfaced to me that project existed. Two, they built the features I wanted. I gave them the bounty and then they kept running with it. I think it's called Meme Amigo. It's like a meme site. You can generate memes and get paid. It's pretty fun. But that's a very early example, but I think it shows the promise of what you can do with these free and open protocols. I had an idea.
Yep.
I tried to build it. I'm not there yet. I put out a bounty. The idea was, let's say 80% complete within 36 hours and I paid the equivalent of $70. That's pretty awesome.
Yep. So that's great. And that actually reminds me of something that I should be sharing that's very relevant to this and actually relevant to a payments idea where obviously we have, you know, good tools that we could use to solve this. So, you know, I'm involved and active with a bunch of different friends and communities that are all doing vibe coding in different ways. And there's one guy in particular, I remember seeing a note from earlier this week, or actually the last few weeks, and he described himself as like completely non-technical, kind of has no idea how computers work. I don't know if he'd say that, but he's kind of just like, I'm like a marketing guy or whatever. And he went in with a very high expectation, tried to vibe code, couldn't get his thing done, but he found somebody who's represents himself as an engineer who could help him. You know, the person's based in India. He's now hired that person. I think he said it's $20 a session or $20 an hour or something. And that person looks at the stuff that he's done and dispatched, and then they kind of mold it into something that is what he actually wants.
Through English prompting or getting into the actual code?
I suspect that they're sharing the session, but I don't know. But my guess is it's more like a vibe coding coach than like, so it's almost like you could try to one-shot it. It's kind of what you're doing with the bounties. You try to one-shot it and then it kind of fails, but now somebody else can be like, oh, I see what you're trying to do here. Let me break this down in the way like, you know, traditional engineer would do, because really to do good vibe coding, you should think about systems the way you do as a traditional engineer. You just get a lot more done.
People are worried about job loss with AI, but there's going to be job creation. Vibe coding coach.
Yeah.
Tell your kids to aspire to that one day.
I mean, it is. And you could just pay. I mean, this person was in India, I think. So he could just like pay them and without dealing with all the, you know,
especially if you have like a borderless currency that you can pay someone.
Yeah.
And what's even cooler than that is, you know, not only borderless currency that you can pay someone instantly in India, but the crazy thing, I should probably be a little careful with this, but like everyone obviously, you know, follow the law, be good and all that. But what's crazy about this is with the Meme Amigo example, I don't know who this guy is. It's a NIM. And that's the beauty of Nostr Bitcoin Lightning. He built this thing. I have no idea where he lives.
Yeah. And you didn't KYC him?
I wanted to say one thing, not about bounties, but earlier, Max, you were trying to estimate, are we going to see like one order of magnitude more people building or two? And, you know, is it 100 million or a billion? But depending on the definition of vibe coding, but I would even include it in this definition. I think everyone will be vibe coders.
Yeah.
And I say that because, not everyone will do vibe coding the way we're using Replit or any of these tools today, but every application, I think, will have like a vibe coding layer on top.
Yep.
And it's a new way to interact. And it's not just that I can text prompt to get what I want, but you can actually customize the application. I mean, kind of like with vibe coding, if you're creating a game and you can be like, oh, I want to be able to change the color of this character or whatever, and then it writes some code and tests the code, and then now you can change the color of the character. Well, you can do that with your application. And to the people using the application, you're not thinking, oh, I'm a programmer or something.
Right.
It's just like, this is how I want, give me the app the way I want it.
Kind of like what you showed me. You showed me a Google Sheets that you had where you had a bunch of data in there, and then you kind of prompted it for some analysis of that data, which is effectively...
Traditionally, I could absolutely go figure out the formula and which command to do, and it would take me like 10 to 15 minutes to do. Then a couple of years ago, when AI came along, like LLMs came along, then I could ask to be told what to do, and it would accelerate it. But now I just ask what I want, and it tells me.
Yep.
And I don't have to edit the cells. And it was just like a really nice integration of AI into Google spreadsheets.
Yep.
But yeah, I think every app will have this. But even more than that example, though, like it will permanently change your user experience.
For everything.
So it's not like a one-off session.
Yeah.
But the next time I come back to the app, like also think about apps. What's one challenge in design around an app? Well, the home screen. Like when you open your app and that first screen, that is the prime real estate, right? You can have many other screens, buttons, settings, like layers, depth. Everyone sees the home screen. Most users don't click around and go to every other screen. The problem we see time and time again, an app will become popular. It does like one thing really well. That's why it becomes popular. But then they add features, and then they add more features. And then it gets very diluted. And you wind up with something, it has dozens of features. Any one individual is only using like 10% of the features.
Yep.
So I think by, learning how the user uses it, what they tell it they want, it'll just automatically recode the layer on top, really the UI, to customize that experience as well.
Yep. So basically every app becomes a very personalized version of the app just for how you want to use it.
Yep.
Yep. I love it. Guys, one potential transition point.
Wait, before we transition.
Yeah.
So keep in mind your transition.
Yeah.
I just want to share my vibe coding success.
Oh, boy.
This week. So I don't know if I told you guys about the iOS apps I've been working on. I think I told you about some of them.
I saw
some
that
of
them, one of you're resurrecting your game.
The
from
game
a
thing.
Long time ago.
That's and so then separate. So and I say historically, if I wanted to get just the basic scaffolding of an iOS app together, kind of pre vibe coding, some concept that I wanted to make, I think it would take about a week to just like because I'm not doing it every day. I'm not like really in the details of app deployment and signing certificates and provisioning profiles and all that stuff, So it just takes like a while to get all that stuff, especially for the iOS world. I was working on that game and then I went on a run.
Uh-oh.
And Jen and I were talking on the run and we came up with this new idea. I looked at my Strava post. I did the thing and I had a working version of it on my phone with a deployed server within 1 hour. Would have taken me a week before. I had that done within an hour.
I expected you to do it during your run.
Come on.
We need voice agents.
Yeah.
But it's just blowing my mind how much you can accomplish so fast.
Yep.
And I think it's just going to revolutionize all of software.
What does it do?
Are you ready to tell
All right. All right. Yeah. Right. I can tell you.
Put him on the spot, Steve.
Have you, we're dog lovers. Have you seen this concept where people are taking a photo of their dog and with a kind of a special sauce prompt, getting a generated version of what would that picture look like if it wasn't a dog, but a human instead?
I'm not aware of this trend.
I'm off social media.
Not sure
right
if it's
now.
Cool or weird, but okay.
It's both. Awesome. Whenever you show it to somebody,
dog person.
It's whenever you show it to anybody, because it's like it has all the same features as the dog, like, the collar or whatever pose they have, the colors. But instead of like the blue collar around her neck, the person's wearing jeans, blue jeans or something. So you feel like you're looking at your dog, but it's actually a human. And it's super creepy and weird, but I have not, and I've shown this now to like a dozen people, and everybody is, it's uproarious laughter when people see this. And then they sit there and try to, then they start sending me photos and like, hey, can you do it with this one? Can you do it with this one? Can you do it with this one? So I was like, okay, I'll just make the app and then I'll give that to people. So I did that in about an hour.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Where did you get this idea from? Or people were already doing
on
this?
The run?
We were, the night before, Jen and I were hanging out. She had found it, I don't know, she saw it on Instagram or something.
Got it, okay.
Originally. And then we were hanging out, we're like, oh, hey, we should do that with this dog and that dog. And then we were hanging out with like her mom and her best friend. And then we sent it to the boyfriend. It just had like a bunch of people started getting involved, wanting to do this and see this, and sort of swiping all these photos around. And it's just like a mess trying to manage. And I'm generating them all myself. And so it's just like, I just build a tool and then everybody can see everybody else's photos and do this funny generation thing. So I'm building dog to human.
I like it.
It's going to be $1 billion.
I was expecting today.
It's going to be $1 billion company.
I got a trash heap for you right here. Dog to human .ai. Let's go.
Are you going to coin it?
Yeah, exactly.
But it is actually expensive to run. So I may.
So yeah. It is going to coin.
It's yeah. I'm not going to coin it. I'm going to
dog coin.
You guys can use it, but I may not make it publicly available.
Do you make it publicly available as an Oster service? 100,000 sats, 10,000 sats,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, I could do that. I could do that.
That'd be sick.
It is something people probably want to pay for. So
I would do it. If you launch it, I'll be your first customer.
All right.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing.
So anyway, that's my little vibe coding update. But I think you're going to take us out of the Nostra world and get us on to next topic.
Now I have to mention, this does remind me of my dad who made an image for me that I love. Many people know I'm a wiener dog lover, among other things. I love Pomskies too. But he made an image for me of Snoop Dogg and a wiener dog, and they both have their eyes about open this. It's one of my favorite
kind of llama eyes.
Yeah. I wonder why. Okay. So the transition point I was going to say, which I thought was very interesting, is so now we have vibe coding, which is amazing. To your point, hey, it's kind of expensive. Wish I could get paid for this. At Bitcoin, Lightning, Nostra potentially is a distribution mechanism. Any ideas on how we could get more people vibe coding and building with Bitcoin and AI?
Bring them together?
And how might we do that?
For 20, like 24 hours
at like
or so?
A certain location.
I was thinking more 36, right? I guess it's 24.
With beautiful scenery?
Yeah, with beautiful scenery.
Yeah, the hackathon.
No,
the Bitcoin hackathon.
Wouldn't even think of that.
Okay.
I think it's the third time we've brought up on the show, but we have some updates, right?
Yep.
We now have an official website, which is Vibe Coded, by the way, by Austin. Thank you, Austin. May 16th, May 17th is the date. Mm-hmm. So it starts Friday night. Mm-hmm. You can pull an all-nighter. It goes all the way through Saturday night. And we're going to have room for 50... hackers, builders.
Cool.
As if you don't already know, you don't have to be an engineer anymore. So basically, do you have a good idea? Do you have a creative idea? Do you have an idea you want to explore, tinker with? Do you want to learn? Mm-hmm. This is a good place for you. You don't have to be an engineer. So we have room for 50 people. We announced it this week. We already have lots of applications flowing in.
Yep.
Super excited about
that. You just visit the website, right?
What's the website?
pbhackathon.com.
Yep.
Cool.
Yep. That's where the application is?
Yep. And you can learn more information about it. You can sign up as an individual. You can participate as an individual. You can also form a team. So one of the exercises we'll do Friday night is a matchmaking or opportunity to meet someone who wants to build a similar idea as you. We're going to have several technology partners here. So there's going to be... there'll be ample tools for you to use. And the experts will be here to help you out with those as well. Let's see. We'll start with, in no particular order, but Lightspark is going to be a technology partner. They have, Bitcoin payment solutions and tools to make it really easy to add Bitcoin payments. I guess before going through that, the only stipulation for what you build, it has to incorporate Bitcoin. You need to build on Bitcoin, add Bitcoin payments. That's the only criteria. You can vibe code, you can hand code, doesn't matter. You can build an AI solution or not an AI solution. You can build whatever you want. You can also build something that is on its own really compelling, but adding Bitcoin payments to it just, you know, makes it that much better.
Like dog to human kind of thing?
Yeah, that's totally fine. So, but yeah, so they're Lightspark, Lexi, which is a startup that works out of Presidio Bitcoin, and Albi Hub are all three Bitcoin payment solutions. I think Bob is going to bring some yet to be published Bitcoin payment solutions. So we have several different types of Bitcoin payment solutions.
Fusats will be here as well.
Fusats will be here as well. Block will as well. And they're going to help people understand Goose and how Goose can help you vibe code and build things and automate processes. Cool. So a lot of great technology partners. Most of the aforementioned are going to be sponsors as well. Block and Lightspark, and then also HRF, Human Rights Foundation, is going to be, they're the three big sponsors, mm-hmm. Which will help with food and drinks. We're going to offer Uber credits to get people to and from here. At least if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, probably not from
New York.
From like the East Coast.
Uber helicopter, I believe.
Sponsored by HiveMind, right?
You know, if you're like a... if you're a student at Stanford or Berkeley and you don't have a job yet, like, you know, we want to make it easy, reduce the friction for you getting here, getting home safely and economically. And then there's prizes too. $10,000 in prizes for, I think there's going to be first, second, third place overall, and then like three special categories as well to give prizes. We're going to have some superstar judges. I think the three of us will be judges, but also beyond the three of us, Brian Murray from Kraft Ventures is going to be a judge. So, you know, Kraft Ventures is a big name in venture capital.
David Sachs is
one of their partners, is the czar of the United States AI and Bitcoin. So like, endorsed by Kraft Ventures. Yeah. But Brian is an investor in numerous Bitcoin companies. So he understands Bitcoin and sees the power and opportunity, venture capital opportunity of Bitcoin. So he'll be a judge and I think, you know, several of those technology partners and sponsors are going to, you know, each of them have a judge as well. So, and then also the whole world can be a judge because one of our prize categories is like fan favorite. So
we're going to be live streamed.
Yeah. The top, I forget how many, but you know, it's top five or eight or whatever, projects that are built will, do a live global live streaming demonstration of what they built. And then anyone in the world can vote by sending Bitcoin, as a measure of voting. And I think the way we're going to do it, each payment would be a one vote and count the same. So if you send 1,000 Bitcoin and I send 100 Bitcoin, meaning sats for those not following along, they count. They each count as one vote.
Yeah.
But the total amount of Bitcoin sent would be part of the prize pool for the winner of that category.
So it just tops up the stated prize pool's $10,000, but it will grow by whatever kind of vote.
Yeah,
the prize pool itself.
D++ has built this out, and we're gonna use it. I think we need to do a lot of testing this beforehand because it just sounds like something that's gonna fail, and we don't want it to fail because it'll be awesome if it works.
That'd
right?
Be so good.
It'll be super cool to let anyone around the world see these, vote, and contribute to the winner. So I think it's gonna be a really exciting event.
Yeah. And are we also doing the video game bracket? Is that happening? The D++?
Probably. Tell us more.
Well, I think
I don't want to pre-announce if she's.
I think she's going to have the video game and people are going to play it. I don't know if there's a prize category for it.
No, but it's like,
it's for fun.
Yeah, for fun.
Yeah.
They'll
definitely be fun.
Lightning payments to compete. And there's like a bracket, I think. So if you're good at Mario Kart, come and show us what you got.
Okay.
Mario Kart with actual sats is the idea.
Yeah.
So. Yep.
Bitcoin.
And so, yeah, I think there's like tremendous, I think the timing is right now due to the huge improvements to Bitcoin payment technology solutions and making it credible to build something compelling in a matter of hours, and the evolution of AI. So we just need creativity and ideas and people here with those creativity and ideas, and it'll just be a blast.
I think. Bring your energy.
Yeah, let's go.
Yep.
So, anything else on the hackathon or
no?
Okay,
you want to do XXI?
Let's get there. But I was going to say, just you mentioned Brian and Brian Murray and Craft Ventures. And there's that topic that I think we've touched on in a couple different flavors. One is like, should there be the concept of a Bitcoin focused EIR, like an entrepreneur in residence? And can we help that ecosystem form? Can we help instigate that? And then there's a separate but related thing, which is like, how do we just create more connectivity? Like Brian had the idea, like, where are all the angels who are interested in Bitcoin meeting with all of the venture capitalists who are interested in Bitcoin? Like, there's just sort of a missing connectivity or network there. So like, how do we solve that? Is it a series of private dinners, or like, how do we do that? And can we put out the call for people who are actively angel investing or venture capital investing in the ecosystem? Let us know, right? So what would that look like? Have you guys already been noodling on it a bit, or?
For the last 5 years.
But do you host like regular dinners? Because I've never been invited.
Well, I mean, to,
no, I guess I have once.
Yeah, you actually have. Yeah, but both you have.
it was pizza on your living room floor.
I don't think I've been invited.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, Max is going to have to go check his notes.
I'll have to check my notes, yeah. No, I mean, to be clear, I mean, to give everyone context, I mean, I have a very small fund. I mean, the first fund was $21 million. The second fund is, you know, several million dollars as well. So it's I mean, compared to something like Craft Ventures or some of these big guys, those are much, much larger funds. Although some of our LPs are larger funds, like folks from Ribbit, Founders Fund, et cetera. You know, I have really thought about this since I started my fund in 2021, about how do you build that connectivity between, like you said, angels, small funds like my own, larger growth funds. And I think there have been many attempts at this. One of the challenges is the Bitcoin, there is a large Bitcoin investor in venture capital and angel space, but it's extremely decentralized. Part of the reason that, you know, so much of the venture capital ecosystem has worked in the past is it's like just all been in San Francisco, right? And or the San Francisco Bay Area. And so it's easy to get folks together. The reality is, as we've talked about many times in the show, after the block size war, San Francisco became the crypto hub. There's tons of major crypto funds here, but very, very few, I would say, other than myself, I don't know anyone, you know, any fund that's really focused on Bitcoin. The closest would be Brian. And Brian is the OG who invested in many of these companies like Lightning Labs and River and whatever, all these companies at the very beginning. But then even his fund went a lot more into Solana over the last couple of years, as is like well documented, even though Brian is an OG and understands Bitcoin himself. And so I think the first thing, and so there are, you know, there have been groups of VCs and angels, but they're all over the world. Lots of them are in Texas. Lots of them are international. A couple in the Bay Area, but not a ton. I think the first thing is, you know, finding folks, not just who are into Bitcoin. I mean, yes, Bitcoin dinners with, you know, the sort of closet Bitcoin VCs like Brian. And I think you introduced me to someone from GC, a few others. Like there are people that are Bitcoiners. Founders Fund, there's a couple. And getting them together with angels. But I think another big piece of this is getting folks who maybe were Bitcoiners, started experimenting with crypto and saying, hey, this is pretty cool because I like decentralization. That Bitcoin thing is kind of dead. And just getting them to realize, wait a second, actually, Bitcoin is still around. Like, I know you guys are great, you know, friends with funds like Electric, others. I mean, I think that to me is another huge area of opportunity is how do you mix them with folks like us and folks that do get Bitcoin and realize, wait a second, there might be a lot of opportunity to invest here.
And, you know, they don't hate Bitcoin. They just like don't see a lot of stuff show up that looks like it's investable.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like if, you know, they can pick from the menu. They don't necessarily create companies. They see companies that get created and they say, is this one of the best opportunities to deploy capital? Not like, hey, I want to ideologically get behind Bitcoin. It's more like I want to invest in the best companies that are likely to have the best returns.
Right.
So in a sense, we need to sort of create enough connectivity that entrepreneurs attracted, they say, I want to work in Bitcoin, but I don't know exactly what to do. That's kind of the EIR concept, right?
Right. And so I think now is the time to revisit, reconnect with people. I mean, the, you know, the Brian Murrays of the world who remain believers in Bitcoin, but I mean, he would love to see 100x the business ideas that incorporate Bitcoin that are attractive opportunities. And even those who, like crypto VC funds that aren't really, you know, rarely or never invest in Bitcoin stuff, but they do other, you know, tokens or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, speaking with them, that none of them hate Bitcoin. None of them are like, have written it off. It's more just like, yeah, where are the opportunities? But as we've been discussing week after week, we think we're on the precipice for lots of opportunities. I think the hackathon will be a nice data point. What gets built? So the trends of vibe coding, and then just the trend of like improving Bitcoin technology and Bitcoin payment technology, those two trends intersecting with each other this year, I think is going to, I'm 100% certain there's going to be order of magnitude more things built.
Definitely.
And when you get law of large numbers, a lot of it will be like not compelling, but when you have thousands of people building thousands of applications, some will be compelling. And I think we're going to start seeing adoption. And when we see that, what are we going to, we're going to see an explosion of investment opportunities. Yep. And then that'll beget more, it'll spur on more creativity and innovation. Cause like, then all of a sudden you get this proof point. Oh, finally someone created a killer app that people like to use. And then there'll be a bunch of copycats of that, but it'll also spur on other innovation. So I think the timing is right for that. So the timing is right to, connect or reconnect with venture capital industry. Yeah. In addition to the hackathon, though, another observation we have at Presidio Bitcoin is that we have one, maybe two people who want to become members who, it just sort of dawned upon me last week in speaking with a few other people here, a couple of people were talking to me about like, how can we attract more people to become members here? And we were just brainstorming like, well, who do we want, as members? Yeah. And how do we attract them? And it made me realize, and a Bitcoin EIR, Entrepreneur in Residence program, is a good idea. It also, and then I'm like, it actually describes the two people who are about to become members. Cause one, is a co-founder of a very, very large company in the crypto and Bitcoin space from 10 years back or so. Mm-hmm. Right. And he's on the sidelines right now. He loves Bitcoin, still loves Bitcoin. And he's just thinking about what to do next. And he wants to build a Bitcoin company. He doesn't know what it is. So he sees the energy and community that has been developed at Presidio Bitcoin. He wants to be part of it.
Yep.
And he's convinced. So for people not familiar with an EIR program, this concept's been around for decades in Silicon Valley. Like venture capitalists will be like, superstar engineer at Google or superstar PM or someone who just exited their startup. All these people are on the sideline thinking about what to do next, or they want to build a company. And the VC is like, come work out of my firm, give you $100,000 for a year, and you just think about what you want to build, right? And why does the VC do that? Well, they build a relationship with that entrepreneur, and then the entrepreneur, they're a good candidate to create an amazing new company. And that VC either has a legal contract where they get right of first refusal to invest, or just they build a relationship and they're
it's more natural to
invest. So that's the VC incentive, and you can see the incentive model for everyone involved here. But in this case, people are willing to pay Presidio Bitcoin for their membership.
It's almost too good to be true.
Not get paid $100,000 just to think about what next. But the benefit they get is like a really cool place to work. And they're around a ton of smart people. They're around other startups. They're around open source developers, technical talent, product thinkers.
Yep.
All the events that are, have occurred or are going to occur here, like Design Week and hackathons.
Yeah.
So I think it's really compelling, even if they don't get paid $100,000, for people who are thinking about what's next. I mean, we already have four startups working out of Presidio Bitcoin.
Yeah.
They're at the seed stage, but this is like the pre-seed stage, right? Yeah. And then that's a very, because once you get too big, Presidio Bitcoin's not your, once you raise a Series A, you have 10, 15 employees, we just simply can't accommodate that, or you'd overrun the space and Presidio Bitcoin would become XYZ Co.
Or we just take over the entire building.
Or we take over the Presidio. But at least with our current confines, we can accommodate 1 to 3 person startups really well. And we're already doing well with that. This would be, pre-seed stage, pre-incubator or pre-incubator. But I think it would be an amazing prospect. I mean, it's already happening without us calling it that.
Right, right.
So we're just talking about, maybe we should create a Bitcoin EIR program. And it can just simply be yes, you have to pay for a member. Our program is you have to pay for a membership. You get all these benefits working out of here and leave it at that. Or maybe it evolves over time.
Yeah.
And maybe we start reconnecting with venture capital industry for and they start seeing the, you know, seeing what's the energy and all the momentum at Presidio Bitcoin, that they see that there is a trend towards more investment opportunities, and maybe they will offer, like, for the right candidate, you know, we will pay you 50K, 100K for a period of time, just so you give you some space to think about what's next. So I'd love to see it evolve into that.
Right. So we first get, it's like a very open source ethos. First get the thing working and give it away basically for free in a sense, and then attract, maybe there are commercial interests that get attracted to that thing and sort of find an angle on it. So maybe the person who is the EIR is here hanging out, and then we just welcome angels and venture people in the space. They're meeting people, and organically they're developing relationships, and like, actually, I like the way this guy or gal thinks, and I want to sort of spend more time with them, and then build a relationship, and, you know, great things happen.
Yeah, I love the idea. I mean, obviously, as HVC, I think it's a no-brainer.
And I think when you start with somebody who's already like exited founder, successful background, that sort of sets the tone. But it doesn't mean it's just that. It just sort of sets the tone that is available. That's on the menu.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of, you know, hacker kids who come up with like the next great thing that you're not even thinking about.
Right. Well, I mean, the other person that is potential to go down this path, he's at a very large Silicon Valley tech company. And so that's another path. But yeah, the one you just mentioned, David, I think that's super exciting. More the young, you know, right straight out of university. And we're trying to establish ties with like Stanford and Berkeley and other local universities, because in general, I think Bitcoin is like underserved at these universities.
Without a doubt.
So, so one thing we're doing is this hackathon, and we're actually Max is going to UC Berkeley next week.
Damn.
And we're trying to get,
is he going to wear the biddy suit?
Biddies. Oh. Definitely not.
So, and we're trying to get you a speaking slot at Stanford as well. And so you're going to go pitch to university students.
Speak the good word of Satoshi. I think this is, I am excited about both of those, and I really want to see Stanford and Berkeley and the whole ecosystem just be aware. Like, I think step number one for all of this, for angels, for venture capital, for the hackers themselves, is just know, like, I've mentioned this story a couple of times, but it's important. I was at a dinner with a lot of blockchain from Berkeley students 2 or 3 years ago, and I was so excited. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to meet some great folks to invest in. And zero of them were interested in Bitcoin. They all said, oh, Lightning Network died years ago. We're all building on Solana or Ethereum because they came and gave us lots of money. I think now, as the crypto markets are kind of dying relative to Bitcoin, and I've noticed this just myself with LPs, with you know, people that I've maybe talked to in the past, I'm like, yeah, this guy seems kind of crazy. Do you think it's all going to come back to Bitcoin? You know, people kind of starting to email me again and saying, wait a second, what if you're right? What if it's all Bitcoin and it just evolves and layers? And so I think it's a very good moment to be doing this, where maybe these students are also kind of like, hey, maybe the promise of the world computer 6 years later never played out, but Bitcoin's still growing strongly. So I think that's awesome. Two things I want to also throw out. The EIR or the Entrepreneur Residence Program is a no-brainer. It's amazing. The more we can do to have Bitcoin be the hub, Presidio Bitcoin be the hub of that, incredible. Two things I would like to throw out. I think this is awesome. And I would even be potentially interested in finding some way to sponsor one or two people myself. One is, I would love to see, in addition to a Bitcoin Entrepreneur Residence, a Nostr Entrepreneur Residence. I think as much as we have incredible Bitcoin entrepreneurs here, I don't think we have really anyone other than kind of Bob who's working on Nostr. I would love to see some more energy, at least in just thinking about that at PB. And the second is at the intersection of energy and Bitcoin. So I know we're probably not gonna have time to go super deep on this today, but we had an Earth Day event here, where we talked about solar and Bitcoin. Everyone knows I'm very excited about both of those. And there was, this actually happened kind of organically as well. There was one guy on the panel, extremely, extremely smart, who has exited a very successful energy company operating system for like basically sort of thinking about like how you can kind of like arb with batteries. And increasingly, I think of batteries as like allowing high frequency trading for energy. And there's a lot of implications of that. But he also was sort of a closeted, now out, hardcore Bitcoiner who's kind of like, I'm really interested in something at the intersection of Bitcoin energy. Similarly, as I mentioned a few episodes ago, I have a lot of crazy ideas, and I'm thinking about, could Hivemind partner early or incubate someone with one of my crazy Bitcoin solar ideas? And we just saw each other like, all right, we definitely need to chat. So I would love
that. Would be great.
Yeah. And he's currently in SoCal, but like, maybe this is the kind of thing that could get him to come and move here. So
just another idea we have at Presidio Bitcoin, in addition to the EIR, possibly having an EIR program, would be around how to attract open source developers here.
Right.
And this can be Bitcoin. It could also be Nostr as well. And so these would be people working on important, impactful projects that don't necessarily need to have a business model behind them. They're unlikely to be a venture capital investment, but they're really important to the protocol of the infrastructure. So we already have several people like that here. That's great. It's a good start. How to attract more? And so like one idea we're floating around, and like we've spoken with, you know, with Alex about it and Haley coming up with good ideas, but having like a residency or, attract visitors for three month stint, maybe.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Right. So like you can be like, there are a lot of developers in open source Bitcoin are nomadic, right? They don't really, they move around. And so giving them the opportunity to come to Presidio Bitcoin for 3 months,
mm-hmm.
give them free membership because they're helping create a public good.
Yep.
Presidio Bitcoin can give back to them, give them a free membership, and they can work from here. And they get all the benefits we talked about for an EIR program. They're like a super strong community here. There's just a great vibe and energy. And they'll probably learn a lot. They'll also be able to spread their ideas. Like they're working on a project they think's important. And they get to spread it to people here, not just the members here, but also we have so many other visitors that come through here that, you know, it just gives them many more touch points with people.
Love it.
In person beyond like GitHub and Nostr, but like in person. So I think this is like a no-brainer idea. So we'll likely do it because everyone that we've talked about so far likes the idea. So we'll probably do something like that. We can, there's different ways to sort of deliver it. One, we can just simply announce like, here's a program, apply. And like, if, you know, if you're accepted, then come hang out for 3 months. We're going to like for people for, we'd like to do this globally, right? So, we have to work through, you know, visas and like, how do we get people who aren't in the United States here for that 3 months? We know of at least two other Chaincode and Wolf both have already had to deal with this. They've solved that problem. So we're going to learn from them mm-hmm. and see how to solve that problem, how to do it efficiently without a lot of overhead. But we can also take it to, we can add more structure and there's just pros and cons of more structure, but we could make it so that like each quarter there's like a cohort. So like the Q3 cohort. And there could be a theme with that cohort. So Q3 is like, you know, Bitcoin and energy, and Q4 is Nostr, and Q1 of next year is some other covenants or, you know, whatever. I mean, there's like a zillion different topics or themes. And the benefit to that is like, you're narrowing who you're marketing to, but like the people you're marketing to would really be motivated to come because they know at least three other people are working on the same topic as them.
Yeah.
They're going to be there. And there's probably going to be other people that are interested in it as well here. So we'll see if we evolve to that as well. Or is it overcomplicating it? I don't know. But I love this general idea.
I love that idea. Two other things popped into mind immediately. One program to look at and one idea. The program to look at is, I know you're probably familiar with this. I don't know if you've looked at them this much, Sovereign Engineering Cohorts.
Yep. Have you
seen this?
We have a call with Pablo next week.
I mean, so
Alex and I are going to talk to Pablo.
Awesome.
Pablo and Gigi have done, I think, a really good job of getting like the absolute cream of the crop hackers from Nostr to go and stay together. And then they did sort of an eCash focus one. And I have always, it's in Madeira. So it's like, it's a giant pain in the ass to get like, it's an island off of Portugal. I guess for Europeans, it's less of a pain in the ass, but I've been like craving like how cool would it be if we could have our own SEC, Sovereign Engineering Cohort, SEC, here in San Francisco. And so that would be like a dream come true. I love it. The second idea I have on the Bitcoin and venture capital thing, I actually have an idea that I think could make a huge impact. You mentioned that there are a lot of venture capitalists who they're not anti-Bitcoin, but they just don't see the good opportunities, which is fair, especially here in San Francisco. But I would actually disagree that there aren't, you know, good opportunities. Obviously, I've invested in a lot of companies, many of which you guys are co-investors in as well. And, you know, one thing I think that's a challenge is a lot of those investments that I do think are great investments are very distributed. They're not all here in San Francisco. There's a few. Both of you guys were at my LP day where I invited a ton of my companies, but like only one was in San Francisco or maybe two that were partially here. So there are great investable companies out there, I would argue. River is a great first example that comes to mind. Lightning Labs. There's a ton of companies that I think no one would disagree, like, oh, wow, that's super investable, but they're not here. And so one thing I think that could be really cool is to have something like a Bitcoin demo day where we're just like, here are like, you know, whatever, like 15 companies or 12 companies that we think are really strong, and get them to come to San Francisco to do, you know, a presentation on what they've learned, their experience, get a bunch of the mainstream Series A, Series B type investors to come in and see what's going on, and just have them meet each other. Because I actually think a lot, and the crypto funds too, I think they would be shocked to see like, wow, like, you know, Leishman, this is an A++++ entrepreneur I never met, or whatever. Same thing, the Albi guys in Europe or wherever they're from. I think that could go a long way just to show them there are investable opportunities. And also maybe it subtly plants the seed. Maybe more of you guys should be spending time in San Francisco. This is where a lot of the capital is. Maybe you should be hanging out at Presidio Bitcoin. Maybe you should hire people to work out of here, which would be awesome.
Yep, I agree. I think as we, you know, Brian Murray gave us feedback, or he gave us some ideas about how to reconnect VCs. I think there's some like lighter weight ideas there. We'll start with that. Yeah. I think it ends.
Yeah.
Or not ends, but like it evolves into what you've
said. That's like the ambitious version, but let's start with something like basically smart. Let's put a call out that if your checkbook is open, whether you're an angel or a venture capitalist, you're interested in Bitcoin, you're ready to write checks. You don't have to do it the first time we meet, but maybe second or third. You're ready to write checks.
Okay, high pressure.
to companies that are working in the space. Like, let us know and come. We'll host a dinner.
Yeah.
Speaking.
DM Max. Yeah. He's going to organize the list.
So a company thanks. That I believe all of us have invested in is Strike. I know I'm an investor.
Yeah.
I know David is.
Yeah, yeah.
Is Hivemind?
Hivemind as well.
Yeah. And I... What's going on with our investment? I don't know.
Great question.
We're in the dark. Maybe someone in the audience knows more than we do.
Yeah,
but
chime in on the...
What we do know is that this week, there's an announcement, and I don't know how to pronounce it, if it's 21 or XXI, but it's at least a cool way to represent 21.
Yeah.
Hats off for good branding there.
Yep.
But that new company was announced with investment from Tether and SoftBank to the tune of $5 billion, 42,000 Bitcoin. So whatever the math is on that. And the CEO is going to be Jack Mallers, someone we all know, we all love. We've invested in Strike. So let's talk about that. But then also, we were wondering, like, is this good or bad for Strike? And also, I'm a customer too. I use Strike. So is it going away? Are they going to get a new CEO? Is it going to be acquired by this company, or like what's going on? And we still don't really know. But Jack Mallers did come out the following day. I think a lot of people probably asked him like, what's going on, or like, what is the future of Strike? And you know, he emphatically said, I'm the CEO of both companies. I'm still the CEO of Strike. He also published a lot of financials around Strike, which had not been public before either, and they weren't zero, right? So we should talk about their
Steve was expecting them to be zero. He's like, they weren't zero.
A lot of confidence.
Startups are hard in general. Bitcoin startups are hard. So happy to see that it was not close to zero, but you know, kind of promising numbers.
It was substantial, right?
So we should talk. We'll talk about those numbers too. So I mean, I don't know.
I'll say it to David. No, I think it was a great transition. Yeah. Great setup. I don't even know. Yeah. I feel like it's now my turn to ask you questions about this thing that you.
Yeah, me too.
I'm becoming an expert on how to transition on this.
Tells
show.
Everything.
Yeah. What is 21? If I could just summarize, my understanding of 21 is it's a new company that is kind of put together by a few different players that you mentioned, and Jack Mallers is the CEO. They hold a bunch of Bitcoin. I think it's something of a SPAC into the, who is it, CEP or something? Is it?
What's CEP?
I don't know what that is.
Oh, okay.
You mean Cantor?
Cantor, yeah. Oh, okay. They have some sort of public entity that I think is going to acquire the thing, or they're going to spin out or turn it into. I don't know the mechanics.
I also don't know the details, but I think it's going to be. But I believe they do. I mean, they facilitate SPACs.
Yeah, something like a SPAC, yeah.
Something SPAC-like where... So Tether's going to be a big owner. Cantor is going to be a big owner. Mallers, and then there's going to be some other shareholders, I guess. But effectively, it's something... SoftBank. SoftBank, right. It's huge, right? So my understanding is it's something of like a mini MicroStrategy or a MicroStrategy kind of that strategy played again in the public markets. We've talked about MicroStrategy in the past. We've talked about like, you know, I think we had even on our first show many months ago, we were like, oh, who else would do this? Could this be done?
Literally our first show.
Yeah, it was our first show, right?
In November.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're like, could this be done? Could somebody gather up enough Bitcoin and personal media brand and stuff to like actually make it happen? None of us proposed this one, but it actually makes sense.
Now that you proposed Chamath, which is a good speculation and still could be the case, but we didn't. Yeah, we didn't speculate this one.
He was
the
spec king.
We did not speculate this
probably.
It's at least formidable with the players at hand here. So what is that? Well, first of all, is it a direct competitor to Strategy? On the surface, it seems like yes. So is it obviously yes, or is it somehow positioned differently?
So I'm not a capital markets expert, but my understanding is a lot of what makes Strategy work the way it does is because of the terms they have on the loans they have and how they've tapped convertible debt and preferred offerings. And like, they've just set up a bunch of capital structures that enable them to do a very special thing. So they're not going to get liquidated because they're 5-year terms or whatever. And anybody new who comes in, presumably, whether it's, you know, like Semler Scientific, you know, Metaplanet, I think GameStop has been rumored but hasn't come in, but I think
Marathon definitely.
Marathon. So anybody who comes in presumably has to find different capital structures or different capital market participants who want access to this slightly different version of the same kind of pattern. Is that right? Or is it just like, oh, these markets are so huge, you have to call up a few people and it's just like, all the same playbook played again and again.
I think it's important first to even take a step back and recognize something. I mean, we talked a little bit, this might have been the show where we were doing mostly Nostr stuff. And we talked a little bit about Pierre's company as well, which is also thinking about securitizing Bitcoin, which is very interesting to me. And I think the first thing is if we recognize, the strike numbers we should talk more about, even though those are very promising. I still think Keane had an interesting post on Stacker News, take it with a grain of salt in terms of, you know, profitability and revenue and all that stuff. I think the broader point that I would just like hammer with the, you know, hammer on the nail over and over again is, as much as we've all invested in payments companies and we want that to work and they are working, they're the long sort of steady, slow burn. What the market has screamed it wants right now is access to Bitcoin exposure for different kinds of capital structures and effectively for Bitcoin holding companies that know how to securitize, slice and dice, and give access to Bitcoin returns to different pools of capital. That's what Michael Saylor has proved. That's why his company has outperformed everything. Specifically, you know, I know there's been a lot of drama with Coinbase going and building Caesars instead of building JP Morgan, which was a tweet from Leishman. But to me, I think that's the first thing is just recognize, as much as I want it to be time for payments now, and maybe it will be very, very soon. The reality of the situation is if you're just an investor and you're listening to the market wants securitized Bitcoin, full stop. Now, the next question becomes, how much does the market want securitized Bitcoin? What are the structures it wants? And so in order to differentiate, you know, and we're obviously seeing more and more Pierre as more of a startup came out and said this. Now you see this giant mega conglomeration, Similar's growing. They just did a $500 million offering, Metaplanet in Japan. More and more companies are going to start playing this strategy. How can they differentiate? The way I say it, there's a couple of different ways to differentiate. One is on the structures themselves. So MicroStrategy has been an interesting company because it was already a public company. Obviously, Saylor has control and he has this kind of like one asset that you can either buy or sell, which is MicroStrategy itself. Obviously, within that, he has equity offerings, convertible debt offerings, et cetera. But like ultimately, there's like one public company. Another way you could do this is potentially having a company that sponsors lots of individual, sub companies or, SPVs or whatever that are structured for different needs. That's another way that you could potentially access different kinds of capital markets. And the other thing is what you said is just relationships themselves, right? Like I'm sure Cantor, Tether and SoftBank have all kinds of relationships that, you know, maybe even Saylor doesn't have from years of doing this. I don't know what the winning strategy is going to be, but there's probably so much demand. If you can figure out some unique advantage in either relationship or structuring, I think you'll probably, at least short term, be happy.
I mean, just to add on to the relationships point, obviously Michael Saylor is extremely popular and a lot of people like him, but not everyone likes his style, or maybe not everyone like trusts him or his like the future. So whereas maybe they would trust 21. Are we calling it a 21? Are they calling it a 21?
I think they're calling it 21.
Okay. 21 or, you know, or some of these other options. So I think the relationships aspect definitely is a material one.
And you also might have just like it's a free market, right? You might have very small differences in terms of like, well, maybe Saylor, because he's got sort of this incredible network effect of capital, is offering a 0% note. And then someone else comes in and says, actually, I'll give you 2%. Yeah. And so it's going to be a race, you know, for fees and things like that.
But so with all of these new entrants, and we haven't really talked about GameStop, but that is another big rumored one. He showed up in a picture with Saylor. Saylor seems to be kind of like welcoming the competition. He's kind of like, it's Team Bitcoin, let's all win together. So I think he's taking kind of a kind of optimistic view, encouraging more people to get in. But also, I mean, that will make, you know, obviously more fiat dollars buying Bitcoin makes the price of Bitcoin go up. He's a big Bitcoin holder, so that helps. But it also seems like it would hurt the MNAV. Like, he gets a multiple on his stock because this is the way you access it. And if in the future there's like dozens or hundreds of ways to access similar products with somewhat better terms, that could actually be a drag on his own equity offering multiple, right?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would just say on that is I increasingly don't think MNAV is the right way to think about value in any of these companies. It's like one proxy, but increasingly it's resonating me with what Saylor says. Like, what they're doing is they're providing value by securitizing. So when he calls them an oil refining company, I think that's like a better way of thinking about it.
Reactor, right?
Something like that. So I think it's more about, rather than MNAV, you know, do we believe that he has some kind of sustainable network effect or advantage or relationships, and you can price forward. You know, if the whole market grows, what percentage of that market share is he going to own in terms of securitizing Bitcoin? I think it's a much bigger risk that like no one else does it than not at all. So than that there's too many players, at least in the short run. So I think it's smart. One kind of crazy idea I want to throw out that I think, I don't know, maybe this is already common. Maybe you guys are already thinking along those lines. The thing I expect to see next, which is going to make this go wild, is sovereign debt. So I don't know who's going to do this. Maybe it's El Salvador. Maybe it's Bhutan. Maybe it's another country in the, you know, UAE or something that we're not expecting. But one massive arb is like, okay, MicroStrategy can do a lot as a public company. These new, you know, public companies or, you know, private companies can do a lot as well. But something that they can't do is access, you know, pools of capital that can only sponsor state grade debt. There's a lot of money in that world. I fully expect, and maybe this kind of gets kind of to the bit bonds idea that's been floated around, we discussed on the show some time ago, but even more aggressive than the bit bonds, I expect to see startup countries like El Salvador, maybe it's Singapore one day or whatever, that are like, actually, no, we're going to offer some of our corporate or sovereign grade debt, but it's a, there's Bitcoin kickers built in there. I think that's one
thing. Is that sort of what, like, didn't El Salvador do, they were buying like one Bitcoin a day or something, and then like the IMF kind of told them to stop, and then they kind of had a little spat back and forth. Was that not them doing a sovereign debt thing, or they were just doing with kind of sovereign assets?
I don't know the details of their sort of like spat. I don't think they were ever explicitly trying to offer Bitcoin kicker debt to the market. Correct me if I'm wrong. So I think they were kind of starting to tiptoe in that direction. But it would be funny if they got this IMF deal and then said, actually, now we're going to do something that meets the terms of this condition, but allow the market to access Bitcoin debt through us.
Right.
So we got a few minutes left. What is this? What does this mean for Strike? And let's walk through Strike's financials too. I think they presented that they are doing on at least an annualized run rate, $60 billion of.
$6 billion.
That was about six.
85% margins, and with a sweet spot cohort of $50,000 to $500,000.
And zero CAC.
What is a sweet spot cohort?
50,000. Because I think most of that gross revenue, or the revenue, gross revenue, is from buying and selling Bitcoin.
Right.
So this, with this, you know, probably the lion's share or the majority of that six billion, not 60, is from people buying and selling $50,000 to $500,000 of Bitcoin.
Yeah,
so they're going after larger, you know, larger purchasers of.
They kind of run an OTC desk, more or less, or mini OTC,
or micro.
Micro OTC,
micro. Maybe micro. Micro OTC desk, and now the $6 billion though. That's I assume that is the amount of Bitcoin bought or sold, they earn a fee on that. I don't know how much, call it 1% or somewhere in that neighborhood. And the 85% margin presumably is of that 1% or 1-ish%.
So you're saying
certainly it's not 85% margin on 6 billion.
6 billion of that's like Bitcoin coming in, Bitcoin going out because it's being bought and sold exchange. From and to a customer. That's then, exchange. It's kind of like gross services revenue.
Customers pay a fee.
Yeah. That's kind of like GMV, GSV type thing.
Yeah.
But the actual, you know, net to them or kind of is, call it 1%. Is that what you're guessing or that was announced?
In that, I mean, it's something that's not like,
that's
yeah, it's not 50%. Yeah.
On the order of 1%.
Yeah. So that's $60 million of
revenue
to them. And they're
net revenue. And and the vast majority of it flows to them. The other important metric is 600% growth rate.
That's year over year?
Yeah. I guess. I don't know. I mean, there's enough details left out that how sustainable or, is it representative of what's going to happen in the future? I don't know. Right. But I mean, still, it's not zero.
I also think $0 CAC was a very interesting, I'd be very curious to see more details on that because that surprised me a lot as well. But
I think that's because he's great. He, does media tours. He shows up on podcasts and on, CNBC or wherever he shows up. And I think that's how you get CAC down to zero.
They're just they're not spending money on marketing.
Yeah, I'm surprised they still don't have like a referral program or something. Anyways, obviously he's in a good position. I mean, again, the one thing, do we, just to kind of like level set here, I think it's great and these numbers are awesome and I'm excited as an investor, this is awesome. But just to like kind of level set, do we have any idea, order of magnitude, how much volume does like, I don't know, Coinbase, I'm assuming they're the leader, like how much do they do?
I don't know offhand, but I'm guessing it's two orders of magnitude.
I think
more or something. I
mean, it's probably in their public statements, right?
Yeah.
And I believe Cash App. I know the Cash App number. I believe it would be in the public quarterly statements. But just to be safe, let's just say that it is in the ballpark of that. So that's impressive numbers by Strike.
Yeah.
And I think
you think it's Strike is in the ballpark of Cash App. You think, but not in the ballpark of Coinbase, probably. Right?
Still, that's true. That's absolutely
super impressive.
It's huge.
I think a big difference is the cohorts. Like Cash App has certainly has way more customers,
right?
Number of customers, but they're smaller dollars.
Yeah,
and Strike has the much larger buys.
So I'm gonna throw out a little bit of an idea here. I don't know if this has been proposed or whatever. It's a little radical.
New SPAC, PB.
Well, I do a bunch of private writing to think. That's just how I kind of get those ideas. And I think I shared this private piece with you guys when I was trying to understand the Sailor thing, I don't know, a couple of years ago or whatever. And one of the things I was sort of proposing is maybe the long game here is there's more operational things that generate revenue that could be layered into owning a bunch of Bitcoin at some point. And I don't know exactly what the time frame is on that. I've heard some people talk about getting yield on the Bitcoin. Maybe that's an opportunity at some point. Maybe there's like the Bitcoin bank and there's other financial services products. So you could imagine, I guess, I don't think I'm the only person, but I think people have imagined what if Strategy, MicroStrategy, what if Strategy were more than just its holdings, but it actually had operational cash flow or revenue opportunities or yield opportunities around the operations of what they do. Probably it's too early for them to focus on that. So they just focus on buying more Bitcoin at the moment. But I wonder if 21 is a Bitcoin treasury company that has a CEO that already runs an operating company.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's, peanut butter and chocolate in there.
An acquisition of peanut butter and chocolate, you mean?
I don't know. Like,
It makes a lot of sense. And even Strategy, they've launched no products, but they've definitely done R&D around Bitcoin and Lightning products. And this might put the pressure on them to accelerate those plans.
And it's hard to launch a new product team from scratch when you don't have like a hub of some...
Well, so then I would speculate there'll be M&A activity. Like Strategy can buy, River, for example, or,
Sailor, if you're listening, I got the hookup for you.
I would expect, yeah. So I think it's very plausible. Obviously, Jack Mallers knows how to build products and create services. So it's what you're speculating is completely plausible and realistic.
As Tether too.
And if it, Tether is building out a lot of protocol stuff and business services. So, I mean, it almost seems like obviously yes.
Yes.
And if it even just the, because it's so obviously yes, that might cause Sailor and Strategy to react sooner than maybe they would have. Obviously, if they actually do start launching services, that'll put a tremendous pressure on Strategy and to follow suit.
And to be clear, we've talked about this at length in prior episodes, but like when we talk about some of the yield opportunities you could do with services, one example we've come back to over and over again is, you know, and I think this is interesting, thinking about Strike has become more of an exchange short term when it started as more of a payments company. Eventually, though, they have a lot of payments infrastructure and expertise. When we have volume in the Lightning Network and you have a ton of Bitcoin, and going back to our original statement, if you own an enviable and well-positioned piece in that network for routing, you know, how much are you making sort of at steady state? Is it 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%? That becomes an extremely defensible and very valuable yield that could differentiate a company like this from, you know, a MicroStrategy or whoever else is not yet running their own nodes.
Yep. So I think we've talked, Steve has made the distinction in the past about how the fact that like a Tesla or a Square Block has Bitcoin on the, you know, in their treasury doesn't make them a Bitcoin treasury company. It's a very different approach. We're sort of contemplating these Bitcoin treasury companies may become more operational over time. And so it may be that there's like a little bit of convergence in the style of like, how much is it owning Bitcoin? How much is it building services to advance Bitcoin and build revenue generating opportunities off of that? But it may be that they're coming kind of from opposite sides and they each kind of converge on each other in a way, which ultimately is going to be great for Bitcoin because, you know, you got more energy, more people competing to serve Bitcoiners and Bitcoin's needs and sort of to make Bitcoin more successful. So,
and this also, I mean, it's all this beautiful self-reinforcing loops, right? Because now with especially Tether being a part of this, you have a lot more incentive for them to get, you know, all of their users. Like, how do we get them on the Lightning Network? Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know. Potentially having TUSD on the Lightning or whatever it is to use here. Tether on the Lightning Network through Tapper Assets
USDT.
Or whatever. USDT, yeah. Thank you. Making
he's so anti-shitcoin that he can't even remember the name of the
I forgot them all. But if you just kind of think about like, it actually, the more I think about this, it's very interesting. Again, I always go back to what's the logic of how the technology evolves, right? The only business models we know have made money for Bitcoin so far, buy and hold, that was number one. Exchange, which is mostly what Strike and most of my companies have settled on in the short run. Now there's financial engineering, securitization. That's
Mining hardware,
yes. But the next one, we always know payments will come. It's just a question of when. Maybe all of these pieces together have led now to this point where, you know, now with all this new capital flood again, companies like Tether being super, super incentivized to make this work through being able to offer a yield to their users. And oh, by the way, it's also very interesting for them because there's a big debate sort of regulatory wise where, you know, US stable coins, you know, my understanding is the regulation is such, at least right now, where it's unlikely to allow banks that are offering stable coins to be able to pass on some of that treasury yield to their users. Well, that means offshore companies mm-hmm. that can do that are going to be able to outcompete US companies. But if your source of yield is not just the treasuries, but instead is actual Lightning Network yield, then all of a sudden that's sustainable. You know, it's extra jurisdictional. The more I think about this, this is exciting.
Yeah, the alignment and the competition that forces everybody to like be Team Bitcoin is like the most exciting aspect of everything we're talking about. It's like better than any price prediction. It's like everybody has to work to make Bitcoin better.
I think I'm more bullish now than I was coming into this.
Yeah.
So amazing show. We're a little over, but it was an amazing
show. We didn't address your
topic. One of our teasers, so I just want to let the audience know, we're going to cover this a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So the Arc, Spark, Lightning showdown, or I don't know how we talked about it. But basically, we've been talking about Bitcoin payment technology is rapidly evolving and improving. So we're going to cover that in great detail, probably over the next several episodes, maybe half an hour each or whatever, because we got hours of discussion and
next 3 months.
I think we should cover it. You know, at least start to cover it before the hackathon, because it really like helps build into that hackathon. So next week we will begin that discussion.
Great. All right.
Amazing.
Look forward to it.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Good time.